Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here. It is Monday, February 2nd. We talk sports tourism and a new economic report on the impact the Honolulu Marathon has across the globe. Its record numbers last year generated 7 billion impressions on social media. We hear more about prediction market gambling, why people placed a half a million in bets on the governor's State of the State address. Should we be worried? We take a look at a new study which challenges the notion that Hawaiians caused mass extinction of native Hawaiian birds. And when artificial intelligence gets it wrong, we learn about the world of cultural tattoos and the growing concern about what's right and what's wrong with AI. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. You know, the Super Bowl kicks off this weekend, but today we look at a sporting event closer to home. The Honolulu Marathon broke records last year with nearly 45,000 participants over the marathon weekend. A new economic report says the $200,000 investment by the state was a good gamble. Dr. Jim Barahal has been president for the Honolulu Marathon for nearly three decades. He says the event generated more than a half a billion dollars in total economic output, and it also generated over 7 billion social media impressions across the globe. We talked to Barahal about what the numbers tell us as the state tries to grow sports tourism.
Last year, in terms of numbers for the Honolulu Marathon, was by far the biggest ever. We had over 43,000 participants, so just incredible growth coming from all over the world. And so last March, when I saw the early numbers coming in for the marathon, I realized that they were going to be quite big. And we hadn't done an economic impact study in a number of years, not since 2012. And so in a lot of the interviews I was doing, I was throwing around numbers that were based on the previous study. And I didn't want it to go too big because I didn't have the data to back that up. So we did do an economic impact study, and it just came out. And the numbers are quite staggering. The total economic output for the Honolulu Marathon in 2025 was $532 million. Generated, I think, $32 million in taxes. I mean, up and down the board on these numbers are just astonishing. To put it in perspective, because I've looked at reports from other large events, the direct spending from this Honolulu Marathon is equivalent to a half a Super Bowl. So the Honolulu Marathon right now at its current size, every 2 years, is the equivalent of bringing a Super Bowl to Hawaii. And I know it's not seen in that light, but the reality is, from a direct spending point of view, it's become, I think, very important. And I'm really grateful to Mark Rich Research and for putting this study together. And I think it's become an amazing event for Hawaii, and not necessarily seen in that light all the time.
Well, you know, there is much talk about how we need to do more to grow sports tourism. And we took a hit, you know, last year with not having the Century Golf Tournament, right? And big question mark as to whether the Sony Open will continue, because that contract is up. And so people are a bit nervous. And, you know, thank goodness that the marathon brought in the number of people that you did. And, you know, when I was thumbing through it, the Japanese numbers always just seemed to really just impress me. You know, I mean, my gosh, even with the downturn, you know, I mean, it hasn't bounced back to where it was before, but still, I mean, was it 12,000, I think, that came?
Yeah, we had 11,994 participants, so nearly 12,000. We're about 80% back in the Japanese market from 2019. Where we've really grown, though, is the mainland U.S. I mean, those numbers are astonishing. We have more from the mainland U.S. now than from Japan, and with other international. We're a little over two-thirds, I think, from outside of Hawaii. And what the study showed, because it was a very comprehensive study, they received over 2,000 questionnaires filled out. This was done on site. That's a huge sample size for a study, which I think helps confirm its accuracy. But the number of people that came with the participants is really quite remarkable. So it was 170,000 people, I think, actually came for the marathon. This is a scale that's really unprecedented in Hawaii. It's very different, too, than a spectator event. I think all the events have value. I think the losing the Sentry on Maui was a big loss and, in fact, may have been a bit of a catalyst to put the Sony Open in jeopardy. But those are not events really where that many people come. I think it's more impressions and eyeballs on television. The Honolulu Marathon is very different in the sense that the participants are the ones that generate the content and goes out on social media. We had 7.7 billion impressions, 7.7 billion for the Honolulu Marathon. So people come and they participate, they take pictures, they share it around the world, and the kind of the viral effect of that is astronomical. So when we look at sports tourism, there's two types of events. There's participation events, and then there's spectator events. So, you know, if you look at a Super Bowl, and I said earlier that we're half a Super Bowl in terms of the economic impact, of course, there's tremendous eyeballs on that from television. But I'm not sure that if you have a Super Bowl in New Orleans and people watch it on television, and we all do, I'm not sure we're going to say, hey, you know what, I think I'm going to go to New Orleans next year. It's kind of self-contained that way. So I think the idea that I've been reading about, at least, or perhaps trying to get more participation events to Hawaii is a good thing as opposed to just events that are on television, because that market is getting tougher and tougher.
Well, you know, I mean, I don't do marathons anymore, but I did, you know, a dabble in the Mary Mile and a start to park, you know, and so even just local residents, like I said, they have opportunities to participate. And it's their events affiliated, you know, with the marathon. So if you're, you know, if your husband or wife is running the marathon and, you know, you're not there, you can do other things and still feel like you're a part of it.
Right. The Kalakaua Mary Mile was an event we started a few years ago, and that was really designed to have people that come with people to run the marathon to have a chance to do something active, because people now, when they travel, they want to have experiences. This is really what's going on. They want to have experiences. So when I talked about social media and the 7.7 billion impressions, that's really people having an experience and sharing that with friends and people they know and on their social media. That's how you get this enormous viral impact. So we realize that you come and cheer for somebody, but you can have your own experience. And that's where it differs from a spectator event. So the Kalakaua Mary Mile, which you did, it's really fun. There's a lot of
oh my
people,
gosh,
cross-section of people, all different levels of how fast they want to run a mile. Yet, this year in the Kalakaua Mary Mile, Sinclair Johnson, the winner, broke the American record in the road mile. And that's pretty cool for us to say something's just fun, we're going to have a great experience, just enjoy it. And at the same time, you're going to be part of an event in which an American record was broken. So that's what we strive for, because we want to, even though we're now by far the largest convention in Hawaii, kind of the largest, you know, economic event in Hawaii, forgetting sports for a minute, we understand that at our core, we are an athletic event and we treat all the participants as athletes. So to get an American record in one of our events is really, you know, the kind of thing that we love to have too. It makes the event authentic. It shows that it's for real. So, you know, the marathon, you know, we're very, very proud of what we've done. We do appreciate the support from the city and county and from the state. Mayor Blangiardi has been unbelievable for us. And you cannot have a large city marathon without that kind of support that we've been getting. And we appreciate Director Tokioka. We did get $200,000 the last 2 years from the HTA. And that's been very helpful to help us market, particularly in the mainland United States. An interesting statistic on our study is that for every dollar spent, we generated $125 in economic impact. So that's 125 to 1. So based on the $200,000 we received from the state, that generated $25 million in economic activity. I think that's a good investment for the taxpayers.
And I just, you know, think of when I first did the marathon and my kids, you know, were there at the finish line. And then when I did the Mary Mile, my daughter, you know, ran the marathon with her husband. But it's just been this nice family thing that, you know, the residents that take part in it, it's just part of, you know, where we live. And it's just so nice to see that it has grown over the years.
Yeah, it's you know, we're at least three generations in on this event. So it's really become a huge part of the fabric of the community. While at the same time, it's developed into this huge international event, this huge economic engine. That's a bit of a balancing act, but I think the study indicates that it's working. The number of people that come from all over to Waikiki, mainly, And also a number of the people that come here also go to other islands. The study shows that the direct spending was about $430 million on Oahu, but there's another $100 million on the outer islands as well. So one thing we noticed this year, we saw some comments afterward about the fireworks and that people were awakened by the fireworks. They may have seemed louder because the wind had changed this year. So the wind was blowing.
The atmosphere is different.
Yeah. But we saw some interesting stuff on Instagram when people were critical of the noise from the fireworks. We literally saw thousands of comments from local people who said, kind of, you know, get over it. It's one day out of the year. Mm-hmm. This is an important part of our community. This is our marathon. That was extremely gratifying to us because, as you just pointed out, even in the context of this economic impact report, which is really measuring people not from Hawaii, this economic impact is really from people who come here for the race. At the same time, people in Hawaii love this event. They feel it's a tradition. It's really part of the community. And that again, that we felt very, very blessed that we have this kind of support from the community at the same time we're bringing in so many other people.
We've been hearing from Jim Barahal about the economic impact of the Honolulu Marathon. We'll return to our conversation in a moment, but it's the first of the month, so we have to test the emergency alert system. Stay with us.
On the next Fresh Air, Ethan Hawke. He's been nominated for an Oscar for his performance in the film Blue Moon about lyricist Lorenz Hart. In the streaming series The Lowdown, he's a small-time investigative journalist constantly getting into trouble. He'll talk about his movies and his life, from his years as a teenage film star to today. Hope you can join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
Support for HPR comes from Leeward Theater, presenting the all-female Mariachi Divas de Cindy Shea this Saturday. Tickets at leeward.hawaii.edu/theater.
Let's get back to our conversation about the impact of the Honolulu Marathon on our economy. We spoke with Marathon President Jim Barahal about shifts in sports tourism and the numbers he's already starting to see for next year's marathon. Well, talk about this notion of running because, you know, there's been a resurgence, right? I mean, so many people are now getting into running and talk about the social media aspect.
Yeah, I think it's been interesting for us. You know, necessity is the mother of invention, and the marathon a number of years ago, to advertise in traditional media, you know, television, print, is very expensive. And we didn't really have the resources to do that. So we were really first in on going all digital. And so as a result of that, I think we had a lot of knowledge about how to reach people in different ways. And that's where the world has gone. Like I say, it's about experiences and sharing that experience. And that experience is shared via social media, including influencers. But it's really everybody. And so we know, for example, at the finish line at Kapi'olani Park, we have a number of different photo opportunities there. We have different step and repeats and different marathon branded stuff. People really want to take those pictures. So it's all about the experience. And this is how you get really big events right now. It's the traditional events, it's becoming tough for sports tourism. What I noticed this year, I went to the University of Michigan, and they played in a basketball tournament in Las Vegas in November. It's called the Players Era Tournament. I had no idea. Michigan happened to win that tournament, so I watched the three games. And the team received $2 million in NIL money, which means name, image, likeness, which is a big topic in college sports now. And this is in Las Vegas. You had 18 of the top teams in the country. Like Michigan beat Gonzaga, teams like that. And I realized watching that, wow, the landscape has completely changed. And that's going to be very difficult for Hawaii, to be honest with you, because the Maui Invitational was held the exact same week of that. And the money that's pouring into these events on the mainland is going to be very, very difficult to compete with. And one of the reasons this is happening is because of gambling. We don't really see the sports gambling here in Hawaii because we're not allowed to do it. So like FanDuel and these kind of companies, we don't really see it. But this is also driving a lot of money into these events. So places like Las Vegas and other places are willing to spend a lot of money to do some of these things. So again, the Honolulu Marathon, which, along with a handful of big city marathons such as New York, Boston, and Chicago, are really huge economic drivers. They're on a par with, as I said, with a Super Bowl and a Grand Prix. This is, the Las Vegas Grand Prix also generated probably close to $1 billion. But those events are very expensive. You need a lot of infrastructure. You have to spend a lot of money to get them. The Honolulu Marathon, we don't really have to spend much to bring it here. We don't need a stadium. We don't need a lot of infrastructure. So I think it's a great value, and we're thrilled with the report and thrilled that the community responds so well to us and feels that we're a very important part of Hawaii.
And then if you, I don't know, had a message for our lawmakers who are wringing their hands over how do we grow sports tourism, I don't know, what would you say to them?
I think the participation sports are going to become very important. I don't know if you can scale them to the event that the Honolulu Marathon. That's very difficult. In fact, our half marathon coming up in April, the Hapalua, is also growing dramatically. We're tracking to about 13,000 right now. That's probably going to be the second largest sporting event in Hawaii. But I think the participation events, getting people here to have an experience as opposed to just watching somebody else do something, is probably where the future is. And understanding how to use that to get the social media and all the impressions out there. And I also think it's important when taxpayer money is spent to make sure that the taxpayers are getting return on investment. So some sort of report is probably not a bad idea like we did. That's not what we did it. And again, I said I was kind of shocked by the results, but it makes sense when you see the numbers and how many people are coming here.
Yeah, I mean, the numbers in black and white right there, right? So,
yeah,
good luck for this year.
Yeah, I can tell you right now, because we started our entry for the marathon, the early entry, the day after the marathon. We've kind of started doing that now. My son actually gave us the idea. He went to Coachella, the music festival. Mm-hmm. So you have to learn from these events on the mainland, because, I talked about the Las Vegas basketball tournament. We're not seeing these things. So Coachella, he said he went to Coachella, and he said, it was a big traffic jam leaving there. And he said he was a half hour out from there, and he already got a text message saying, special early tickets for next year. And so he said, so we decided we would do the marathon entry the next day, which I didn't believe would work, but it does. And actually, right now, we're running 29% ahead of last year. We have over 15,000 entries for the marathon in this coming December. So we're tracking to 50,000 this year. And at this growth trajectory, we think that we have a chance to become the largest marathon weekend in the country. And in terms of economic impact, I think we can become the biggest because more people come from farther than any other event. Like the Boston Marathon, for example, which is huge, 50% of the people come from New England. So we have people coming from so far away, and the average person spent 7 days, 5 nights here. So people spend a number of days here and spend a lot of money. So the future looks very good. This resurgence in running, which is mind-blowing to me, seems to, pardon the pun, have some legs.
Right. Okay. All right. On that note, thank you so much for coming in.
Oh, it's always my pleasure. Thank you.
We've been hearing from Honolulu Marathon President Jim Barahal. There is a new study out on the impact that the athletic event has on our state's economy, and it's being shared with state lawmakers this session. We just heard Jim Barahal talk about the impact of the Honolulu Marathon, as well as the impact of sports gambling. And the Honolulu Star Advertiser on Sunday featured an article about something called prediction gambling, and lawmakers are racing to ban it. Here to talk about that is reporter Dan Nicasso. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Catherine. How are you?
I am good, but you know, I have to admit, I didn't know anything about prediction gambling until I saw that someone made money off of the removal of Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela. I was like, what is this?
Right. Big money. Yeah, this was a phenomenon that's been around for a long time, but it heavily has to do with the stock market, things like soybean or pork belly futures has now morphed into betting on all kinds of things. And apparently in Hawaii, there was betting on what Governor Green would say in his State of the State address. How much people won, I'm not sure of, but it was more than $400,000 worth of wagers were placed on what words he would say.
I know, that's just crazy. Your article talks about how State Representative Scott Matayoshi introduced a bill to try and get our arms around this.
Right. It's House Bill 2198, and Rep. Matayoshi is chair of the House Consumer Protection and Commerce Committee, but he actually was talking to a cousin at a family Christmas party, and the cousin apparently knew quite a bit about it and inspired Rep. Matayoshi to try and do something to get the state to control this. Now, as you know, we already have a proliferation of online sports gambling and fantasy sports gambling, and the size of that market is unknown, but there's another bill that would allow the state to tax any revenue. So it's quite a challenge, and you're shooting at a moving target, of course, because, you know, IP addresses can be faked, and how do you know if the bets are being made in Hawaii or not? So very complex, but as you know, Hawaii and Utah are the only two states to ban any form of legal gambling. So people that support that want to regulate it. There are other bills, as usual, that would legalize some form of gambling in Hawaii. So it's always an interesting push and pull about how legislators feel about the future of gambling in Hawaii.
Yeah, I mean, there's the cruise ship gambling bill, right? And there's something mm-hmm. about, you know, a casino possibly here.
One casino mm-hmm. in Honolulu, right. There's been previous attempts to do a lottery of some sort. As you know, a few years ago, Department of Hawaiian Homelands, there's a lot of urgency to clear the backlog of the wait list. They proposed a casino on DHHL land, which was a narrow vote in both the Homelands Board as well as the legislature. So a lot of pressure, as you know, a lot of pushback, as you know. So we'll see if there's any progress this year.
Yeah, I mean, so has Matayoshi's bill had a hearing yet? Do you know?
I do not know that. Mm-hmm. Good question.
Yeah.
It's early days, as you know. This is the time of the session when things could stall early and not get any movement for a couple weeks or keep moving. So we'll have to see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, be interesting to see, because now that they've identified a loophole, right, are we going to try and close it, and how best to do that? Yeah, it's all very fascinating.
Right. Fascinating, yes, I agree.
All right, well, thank you so much, Dan.
You bet. Anytime, Catherine.
That was Honolulu Star Advertiser reporter Dan Nicasso. You can read his stories at staradvertiser.com.
Join Hawaii Public Radio as we continue our Live from the Atherton concert series. We begin with Native Hawaiian artist Gregory Wan, singer, songwriter, and musician dedicated to perpetuating Hawaiian culture, Olelo Hawaii, and hula. Join us Saturday, February 7th. Tickets and details at hprtickets.org, sponsored by HMSA.
A new study takes a critical look at a belief that's made its way into history textbooks and scientific literature. Did Hawaiians really cause the extinction of birds like the flightless ibis or the moana nalo? We reached out to two scientists to help us with the answer. Kristen Harmon is a researcher at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, and Kavika Winter is an associate professor at the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology and director of the Hei'ia National Estuary and Research Reserve. They spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender about their new study. Winter starts us off.
You know, in the 1980s, there were a handful of papers came out by some archaeologists that noticed that there were some really old fossil bones in Hawaii that belonged to flightless land birds. These flightless land birds weren't around when Cook arrived, and the conclusion was made that Hawaiians hunted these birds to extinction. This story has taken root and is taught nowadays as if that is a scientific fact, but what our research has shown is that there's actually zero scientific evidence of Hawaiians hunting these birds. And in fact, if you look closely at the archaeological evidence, most of them actually went extinct before any human showed up in these islands at all.
Kristen, how did you think about approaching this problem? What you end up doing was a literature review. So you looked at a lot of different studies, but where did you kind of come on to this study?
Yeah. At the time of completing this research, I was a PhD candidate. And Dr. Winter here was a PhD advisor on my PhD committee. And we actually had been, at the time, we had been trying to publish some other research that shows the benefit of restoring lo'i kalo across Hawaii and how that actually can help recover our expand habitat for our endangered native water birds currently and help recover their populations. And we were getting a lot of pushback from the scientific community about that claim, which was surprising to me as a new PhD student, but I was quickly educated that this pushback was likely coming from a perception that Hawaiians caused extinctions. We were getting told there was no evidence, scientific evidence, that lo'i kalo were good for water birds.
I think even one of the reviewers said that everybody knows Hawaiians hunted these birds to extinction or something like that. You know, the peer review process is we submit a manuscript for a review by our peers in the scientific community, and they're supposed to assess it and judge whether or not it's worthy of being published and formally contributing to our building of knowledge. And we were getting some people who were saying, no, this research should not be published because we all know that Hawaiians hunted birds to extinction.
Kristen, continue the narrative. What happened then?
Yeah. So again, I was, you know, educated on this longstanding perspective that Hawaiians caused extinctions. And collectively, my PhD committee with Dr. Winter and also Dr. Melissa Price, we decided to ask some questions about what the evidence actually supports. Which possible causes of extinction does the evidence support? And that's what we set out to do in this synthesis of past research.
You look at basically four hypotheses for why water birds go extinct. Give us a rundown of each of them and what they mean.
So one of the most common hypotheses, actually not just in Hawaii, but globally for explaining mass extinction events is the overkill hypothesis. Basically, that implies that humans, particularly indigenous peoples, hunted species to extinction. Another commonly reported hypothesis is the deforestation hypothesis. So it's essentially assuming that indigenous peoples it's commonly cited that they use the word slash and burn, quote unquote, approach to clearing forests, which destructed habitat of species. So that's another commonly quoted hypothesis. But in more recent years, challenges to those hypotheses came about. One was the climate change hypothesis. So it's like it sounds that, you know, changes in climate altered ecosystems and therefore caused some species extinctions. And then lastly, the species introductions hypothesis is just hypothesizing that new species bring about more competition for resources, introduce diseases, etc.
And before we get to what you found in this literature review, Kavika, was there anything that before you did this research, just on the face of it, sat wrong with you of whether or not Hawaiians engaged in, quote, slash and burn practices, whether that felt at odds with traditional indigenous knowledge about land stewardship and all these other land practices that did seem to cultivate sustainability and show an awareness of the environment?
Yeah, you know, there have been three major myths that have shaped how we think about engaging in conservation in Hawaii. And this is important to contextualize in the perspective that Hawaii is the endangered species capital of the world, is the extinction capital of the world. We hear that all the time. Obviously, extinctions are a bad thing, and trying to understand why extinctions took place is really important if we want to understand how to make sure our precious native species continue long into the future. And there have been three myths that have shaped conservation in Hawaii. The first one is, as Kristen alluded to, was the deforestation hypothesis. The claim was that Native Hawaiians deforested these islands in the name of agriculture. That myth was debunked more than a decade ago. There have been several papers that have come out that have modeled Hawaiian agriculture systems and found that only at the most, maybe 15% of forests were altered or converted in the Polynesian era. So 15% loss of forest or change of forest is not deforestation. So that myth was debunked. The other myth that actually I heard myself, I was taught this on a field trip to Bishop Museum in the 1980s, was that Hawaiians hunted our forest birds to extinction. And they said, look at these feather capes. And they pointed to Kamehameha's cape. And they said, they would have had to have killed 200,000 birds just to make this one cape. Imagine how many millions of birds they killed to make all the capes. So those kinds of statements were made in complete ignorance of the practice of bird catching and feather collection. It was very much a sustainable harvest. And we now know that these birds persisted long after contact with Europeans, and they didn't go extinct until the mosquito came in and mosquito-borne diseases devastated their populations in conjunction with the deforestation that happened in the 1800s with plantation agriculture and ranching. So this last myth that has really shaped conservation in Hawaii is this idea that Hawaiians hunted flightless land birds to extinction. So this is the last one that is still uttered at conservation conferences and in scientific papers and presentations and things like that. And like Kristen was saying, we wanted to look, is there really any evidence? Because I honestly have not seen any, but yet I hear this all the time. And so Kristen's PhD committee agreed, yeah, this is a worthwhile thing for you to focus some attention on. So she really took the lead at conducting this synthesis study, pulled together all of the available archaeological studies and really looked at them, test these previous hypotheses, and found that, you know, not only is there no evidence that Hawaiians hunted these birds to extinction, but the previous hypotheses for those extinctions don't seem to really adequately answer what happened.
Kristen, can you get into some of the lines of evidence you looked at in this literature review? So you cast a wide net and you read up on everything from the fossil record to periods of overlap and timescales. But at a high level, what did you find?
You're correct in how you described that. We synthesized decades of published research to compare timelines of likely waterbird extinctions with evidence of ecosystem change in Hawaii. And that's including changes in vegetation, fire signals from charcoal samples, climate patterns, specifically changes in rainfall, and species introductions. And then, as Kavika mentioned, we did also review archaeological reports looking for any evidence of humans directly using waterbirds, evidence like burning or charring or modifying of bones in any way. There was no evidence that Hawaiians hunted birds to extinction. In fact, there was very little evidence of water bird fossils found in archaeological human sites. And the ones that were found, the bones didn't appear to be altered. There wasn't really any indication that humans were directly using them. And yeah, we didn't find any evidence linking Hawaiians to deforestation. But we did find evidence that water bird extinctions were likely driven by a combination of factors. So this is getting to the new hypothesis that Kavika was referring to. The evidence shows that it was likely a combination of climate shifts, land use changes, and species introductions that likely drove water bird extinctions. Not only was it the combination of those factors, but those factors can actually have cascading effects. So actually any previous extinctions could have caused new extinctions of water birds. And so basically that it's a very complex, not single factor answer is the point. So we're referring to this new hypothesis as the regime shift extinctions hypothesis.
What does this regime shift extinction hypothesis, testing it out going forward, look like?
I'm not sure about what it means going forward as far as the way we're approaching our scientific studies. I think in a lot of ways, you know, there's this Hawaiian saying, "Okawa mamua, okawa mahope." We use the past to inform how we navigate into the future. And studies like this are really important because what actually happened in our past is how we determine how we actually move forward into our future. And so there's this narrative out there in conservation and the popular media that humans are separate from and inherently bad for nature. And wherever humans go, we destroy things, we cause extinctions. And, you know, the more and more we look at it with better tools and different hypotheses, that idea just doesn't hold up, which isn't to say that humans don't have negative impacts, but there's a broad spectrum of how humanity can engage with the world around us. There are ways in which humanity can engage that supports native species and prevents extinctions. And there's ways that humans can engage with the world around us that accelerates those processes and negative impacts on our ecosystems. And if the only story we ever tell is that humans are bad, then what hope do we have for the future? Why should we even bother? Why should we even invest in conservation if all that we're going to do is destroy the earth anyway? So research like this is in a growing body of scholarship that's saying, hey, let's maybe relook at this evidence. Is it really true that humans have always caused destruction wherever we go? And the answer is no. There are examples of indigenous cultures all over the world that have developed societies and systems that have allowed people to thrive in the context of thriving biodiversity. And if that's the future we want for ourselves, then let's look into the past and see how maybe some of our ancestors did it in the past. And if that's really the case, then we can have hope for the future moving forward. And I think that's the biggest message of this paper, is that the future is not all despair. We still have hope. There are people like me who, in the midst of everything, all the science we do, in the midst of climate change and extinctions, people like me still have hope for the future, because I know that humanity has done it in the past. We just need to have more science that highlights the mechanisms and the pathways for creating an abundant future.
Those were researchers Kavika Winter and Kristen Harmon talking with HVR's Maddie Bender. We'll have links to their new study on our website after the show. And it's time now for a break to test the emergency alert system.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii State Federal Credit Union. Learn more about home loan options with an appointment at hawaiistatefcu.com. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Lender.
Greetings, I'm Jeff Long, your Thursday night host on After Hours, Hawaii Public Radio's late night music space, where each night brings a different host, genre, and point of view after dark. Join me every Thursday night for Country Detours, a journey through Americana, country soul, roots, and storytelling. Music to soundtrack your life, After Hours, Thursdays from 10 p.m. to midnight on HPR 1.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training.
Cultural practitioners are concerned about the rising tide of AI-generated images that are getting it wrong when it comes to Indigenous tattoos. Here to explain that is HPR's culture and arts supporter, Cassie Ordonio. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so how did this get on your radar?
So recent online images surfaced on Instagram particularly, and it raised a red flag for cultural practitioner Natalia Rojas, who is a Hawaii-based tattoo artist, and she does the traditional art form of batok, which is the Filipino tapping. And what those images produced was basically a couple slides, a woman who was tattooing a man with either a hair comb or a mallet, and then it was the rows of needles, but that's not actually accurate. And so that has caused a lot of worry among cultural practitioners on the misappropriation, misinformation of how cultural tattoos work. And Roja says that she's been seeing even more AI-generated images of cultural tattoos more frequently.
I feel like it's just disrespectful that there are living practitioners. You want to learn about it, especially here in Hawaii. There's a lot of actual practitioners with actual lineages, with like their ike and their mana'o that is like so vast and wide that you need to go to them. And why are you going to be consuming AI to tell you who you are, what you are, especially when it's like there's a visual representation of it that is not accurate? I mean, the slide that I did end up sharing was basically like literally someone with a mallet and basically what looks like nails. And showing that's how we tattooed. What? Here in Hawaii, go to Bishop Museum. There's implements, tattooing implements to know, to educate, and to know what your tools even look like. That's where I'm like, I'm all up about like ethically used AI. But this is unethical at this point. I mean, where's the boundaries on that, right? I don't know. I don't know how to answer that. The only thing that I can answer is like, I think the boundaries lie within the experience of the person that is receiving, that is like seeking these out, seeking these connections. I'm like, you cannot AI your connections to your ancestors.
That's a powerful soundbite. You cannot, you know, use AI to connect to your ancestors. But this whole thing about tattoos being copied is nothing new, especially for artificial intelligence. But the main question is, are tattoos protected under copyright law? Well, technically, yes, and that's according to Hawaii-based IP lawyer Bill Meyer, and he said protection of cultural works is a sui generis or a category within itself.
In Hawaii, we do have some very narrow types of protections. For example, a nihihau shell type lei is protected under a provision of Hawaii law, but there's really not much else out there. And traditional intellectual property like trademarks and copyright law, trademarks protect symbols that are used to distinguish the products and services of one business from another. Trademark law and copyright law are rather ill-suited for protecting cultural things because while trademark law can potentially last ad infinitum, in other words, forever, as long as you protect the mark, copyright eventually expires.
Yeah, and it expires actually around between 50 to 80 years. So after that, then it's kind of in public domain. But going back to the misappropriation of tattoos, those images sparked a lot of conversations with cultural practitioners because the depiction of tattoos showing that woman using a mallet and a hair comb is not accurate. What tattoo artists actually do use in a cultural ceremony is that they use kind of like these bamboo sticks, or they're made of wood. And then the sharp implement, which is the needle, is either made of thorn or, in Natalia Rojas's case, is a bone or boar bone. or tusk. And so they use that and they put a certain amount of pressure and they tap the ink into the skin using charcoal soot. And it's not just a one person thing. So in the AI generated photo, it just has one person doing the tattoo and then the canvas who's just sitting there. But it actually takes a village. It takes multiple people to get that tattoo or to give the tattoo. And so when I recently interviewed Natalia Rojas and her student, Michael Quintana, Michael Quintana is a stretcher. So he has to stretch the skin to make sure that the skin is in place in order to have the ink enter into the skin. And also, it's a cultural ceremony. So before people get a tattoo, it's a rite of passage. It involves prayer. It involves connecting with your ancestors. And it involves oral stories before you actually go and get it. But there's been conversations among cultural practitioners on where to draw that boundary. And Michael Quintana said that there should be a boundary.
Using AI in anything, I feel like you walk a very fine line between ethical and non-ethical. When it comes to cases where you're using AI to create materials for tourists to consume and I guess get a general overview of what to expect when visiting a place, I think a case can be made for that. But in terms of using AI to create things that will explain a culture to these tourists without any sort of input on the validity of what's being explained from members of that community, I would say that's a big no-no in my eyes.
And cultural practitioners are prone to the same pitfalls from AI as other tattoo artists, because artificial intelligence, they can scrape data from the internet without permission to generate such images. And even some tattoo artists, the contemporary tattoo artists, have had clients bring AI-generated images to have them tattooed. But it's a big deal for cultural practitioners because humans for the last 5,000 years have always been getting tattooed. But we've seen a revival in tattoos because it's been gone for some time after colonial and religious powers prohibiting getting tattoos. For Native Hawaiian tattoos in particular, the traditional tapping actually came back recently. That was in the early 1990s. I spoke with cultural practitioner Kalehua Krug, who is a Native Hawaiian cultural practitioner, and he said that post was inaccurate as cultural practitioners are mostly male-dominated. And he said using AI-generated images in cultural ceremonies is not appropriate. And that should be left up for the practitioners to share with the public.
There are people that don't care, and they're not empathetic for cultures that are trying to revitalize themselves and the people that are involved. And so when people don't care, and I'm not saying that the folks that have generated applications of artificial intelligence are not well-meaning in what they're designing, but to take anything for granted from a cultural worldview is inappropriate, it's irresponsible. And so the question of this ethic, that if we spend some time kind of unpacking the ethics that go into AI, I would say that those same ethics drive many tattoo artists right now that do not respect or have any ethical concern for taking designs, that actual markings are not, they do not belong to a culture. They do not have strict protocols behind them. They do not have a spirit that they generate. Because I would say that from a cultural standpoint, in the equation of logic, that cultural practices are real, that cultural practices have value. They have this intrinsic transformative effect on people, that to take those designs out of artificial intelligence could be damaging to the wearer or the bearer of the mark.
And there are cultural practitioners, they want people to know that if you really want to learn about traditional tattoos, there is Bishop Museum, there is the Honolulu Museum of Art, and also there are quite a few cultural practitioners in Hawaii, such as Natalia Rojas and Krug as well. And they're hoping that if they want to learn, just go to the actual source itself to learn about it.
Yeah, no, it's more than just having sailors go down to Chinatown and getting some image on their arm, right? Yeah. All right, but thank you so much,
Cassie. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we've been talking with HPR culture and arts reporter Cassie Ordonio. You can find her stories online at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Thank you.
Well, that does it for us today. Tomorrow, we plan to talk politics. We plan to hear from the new chair of the Hawaii Republican Party, the third chair in 6 months. Have a story idea to share with us? Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217. And did you know you can find The Conversation as a podcast? Head to our website or search for it on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.